Welcome to the committee meeting for international relations and cooperation. The chairperson has apologized, is not coming to the meeting. So in the absence of the chairperson, we have to elect an acting chairperson for the day. Can we have nominations? Honorable Suleiman?
I would like to propose Honorable Magal.
Second? Any other nominations?
Nomination closed.
Ms. Magal, can I call you to take a chair? Okay, honorable members, good morning and thank you. We have the following apologies for today's meeting. Honorable Velma, the honorable Dudley, the honorable Smart Ngonyama, the honorable Holomisa, and that apology of the honorable Magama. Without wasting time, we will move to the third item after I have officially welcomed all of you to this meeting and hope you have a fruitful meeting. The third item on the agenda is the briefing by the department. You don't have an agenda?
No,
you don't. Okay. Sorry. I'll give you a minute to get that. The committee staff is still sorting that out, but I don't think we'll have a train smash if we proceed with that without that document in front of us. I just said the third item for today is the briefing. Okay, the main item for today is the briefing on the development in Somali. And then we will get a perspective of the development by the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. And they will be followed by Professor Gavbai. And lastly, we'll get an analysis of the disaster relief process by Dr. Suleiman. And then we will interact with the three presentations. On behalf of the department, to take us through, we have Ambassador Mulikane, is that correct? And Ambassador will be assisted by the able Miss Adams. Ambassador Mulikane and Miss Adams, we now hand over to you to take us through. Okay, just hold on, Honorable.
I thought you were going to acknowledge our chair of the presiding officer.
Ambassador Mulligan and Ms. Adams, just ignore what you have just heard. Can you proceed with the presentation?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Honorable members, thanks for the opportunity to make this very short presentation. Let me first apologize on behalf of our Deputy Minister Franzmann, who could have loved to be the one doing this presentation, but due to other engagement, he couldn't make it. Let me also thank the Dr. Suleiman for the gift of the
But the problem is, you will be able to see him, but he will struggle to go through the presentation. Oh, you have the other one. Okay, thanks. Ben, can you come over? Okay. He normally doesn't come. So he's excited to see you.
Thank you again, Chairperson, honorable members. As said, my name is Rafu Mulekani from DICO, and I'm accompanied in this presentation by Zahir, Ms. Adams. She is the director responsible for the Horn of Africa. As I said, I would firstly like to apologize on behalf of our Deputy Minister, Franzmann, who should have made this presentation himself, but due to other engagement, he couldn't make it here. We would also like to thank the gift of the givers for flying South Africa's flag high in this international travel part of our continent. The Deputy Minister actually received the delegation as they returned yesterday at the airport. Our presentation will look at four issues: a brief political background, and then the security situation, the humanitarian situation, and our response as a country. As you know, Somalia has been without a functioning government for over 20 years now. Of course, Somalia, we have a transitional federal government which was established in 2008 following a very long civil war. The establishment of this transitional federal government is supposed to rule the entire country, but as we know, at the moment there are three parts to that country. This agreement of establishing a transitional government was welcomed by some sectors of the Somali population, and it is supported by the international community, but a number of clans and groups within Somalia had not welcomed this transitional federal government, especially the Al-Shabaab group, which feels that this government is not inclusive and it is centered on Western ideas. Since 2009, the TSD has had three different prime ministers and two speakers of parliament. It has been plagued by a lot of infighting, especially between the president and the speaker of parliament. And as a result, it has been very much ineffective. Elections scheduled to take place at the end of August 2011 have been postponed for 12 months until August 2012, with a belief that there would be some stability in Somalia. The political situation in Somalia has allowed the security situation to deteriorate, with the TFG only in control of a few areas in the capital city, Mogadishu. Yesterday we heard that there has been a unilateral withdrawal of some units of Al-Shabaab in Mogadishu, ostensibly to allow for humanitarian aid to pass through some of the towns that they are controlling. The insecurity that is there has resulted in a large number of internally displaced people fleeing to the border Somalia shares with Kenya. Yeah, this insecurity has also been exacerbated by the presence of the AMISOM, who are supporting the TFG in its offensive against Al-Shabaab. As I said, Al-Shabaab controls most of the regions in southern Somalia, which still remains contested, and there is constant conflict between the TFG forces over Mogadishu. As we said earlier, of course, Al-Shabaab regards the TFG as an exclusive Western-centric government. Al-Shabaab is also hostile towards AMISOM, as they feel that this group supports the imposed government, which is the TFG. Last year in July, Al-Shabaab attacked or claimed responsibility for the attacks in Uganda as a warning to Burundi and Uganda to withdraw their troops to make up the large portion of the AMISOM. Let me move to the humanitarian situation. The humanitarian situation in Somalia is deteriorating on a daily basis. Presently, it is estimated that over 3.7 million Somalis are in a state of dire crisis. Southern Somalia, which is mostly under Al-Shabaab control, has been the most affected region, with Mogadishu also declared as one of the most affected by this famine. The UN has called on the international community to mobilize itself and to contribute any form of assistance it could to the people of Somalia. The AU has also declared that it will be convening a pledging conference on the 25th of August in Addis, where African countries are expected to make pledges towards alleviating that situation. We know that this conference was supposed to take place last week, that it was put on hold so that proper consultation should take place. Now, when we look at what South Africa has done, the government of South Africa has to date raised about 8 million rands, which has been donated by a number of government departments. BICO has appealed to other national departments to assist wherever possible in providing aid. South Africa is working with locally based aid organizations, and these include the Gift of the Givers, as I said, that they have just returned from the Somalia, and this is being done in cooperation with the public broadcaster and the International Marketing Council. Other groups include the African Muslim Agency, the Islamic Relief of South Africa, Medcare South Africa, Al-Imadat Foundation. The decision for South Africa to cooperate with these organizations is based on the fact that these are the organizations, apart from Medcare, who have representation on the ground in Somalia and Kenya and have been able to provide the department with very useful and relevant information pertaining to the most affected regions and the kind of aid required as well as the security situation. Of course, we are coordinating our efforts with the AU as well. Analysis was also conducted through our diplomatic mission in the region. We do have an office in Addis and also in Kenya. Due to the challenging terrain, the instability and lack of trust by Al-Shabaab or foreign organizations, only about 20% of the 2.8 million people affected in southern Somalia are receiving aid. An amount of about 4 million from various government departments has been pledged to the Gift of the Givers, who have set up a camp in Mogadishu distributing food, water and medical assistance to the internally displaced people who have moved towards Mogadishu in search of help. Additional plane loads of aid will also soon depart South Africa for Somalia to enhance these efforts that are already at place. Government contribution to the Gift of the Givers will serve to cover the exorbitant cost of transportation of these goods. An additional 4 million will be distributed between other organizations that you have referred to. South African civil society and communities have been mobilized and the response has been quite phenomenal. The Islamic Relief and African Muslim Agency have long been established in Somalia and have distribution centers in most of the affected areas such as Lower Shabelle, Faukul, Bay and Padua. They also have sustainable development programs in cooperation with the UNDP and other organizations. In addition to the emergency relief, much of which they are conducting on behalf of the World Food Program, who cannot reach these areas. Both these organizations also have presence in the refugee camps in Kenya. The Al-Imdad Foundation has already indicated that it would be delivering assistance to the refugee camps along the Somali-Kenya border, particularly at Dadaba, which has reached capacity with aid workers and volunteers struggling to keep up with the daily influx of people crossing the border. Medcare has deployed a fact-finding mission to the region and have indicated that they intend to establish a field hospital at Dadaab or at Ifo to see to the primary health care needs of the refugees who have deployed a fact-finding mission in the region. The Somali diaspora in the region, in South Africa, have also mobilized to collect funds for the aid of their own families and people. Through the government endorsement of this, South Africa and South African-based aid organization, the humanitarian assistance will be given a South African identity and continue in the spirit of Ubuntu, in line with our policy towards an African agenda. We host a whole lot of Somali communities in our country. figures are estimated at about 40,000 who have come as refugees or just as entrepreneurs. The aid from South Africa could therefore be regarded as a gesture of goodwill to the people of Somalia. President Zuma has endorsed a comprehensive strategy for Somalia during the State of the Nation's address in February 2011, which includes development, capacity and institution building. It is envisaged that through the partnership formed for delivery of aid, some of the long-term goals in terms of this strategy can be rolled out to assist the people of Somalia in bringing peace and stability in their country for a sustainable livelihood. Should a natural disaster like drought and famine ever occur again? Chairperson, as you know, we are speaking about the country engulfed by war, and relief efforts are hard to deliver. And this is exacerbated by this long-standing civil war that is taking place in that country. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Adams, is there anything you want to add?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that I'll come in if there are any questions that are posed.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Ambassador. Honorable members, I think we should take the second presentation because they all deal with one thing, that is Somalia. And the next presentation will be by... Sorry? Yes, Honorable?
No, instead of the person, let's deal with the government is government.
Okay.
So that we can be able, as members of parliament, to present our question to what is the role of the department before making the policy.
Okay.
Because if we treat it like that, it seems the citizens will have to answer on behalf of government.
Okay. Was that the same concern? Okay. Honorable members, we have been called to order that government is government and others will come with their perspectives after the committee has interacted with the government presentation. And I now open for members of parliament to interact with the presentation that has been presented by Ambassador Mulikani.
Mm-hmm.
Do I see him? Honorable Jacoba, Honorable Mukhalapa, Honorable September, and Honorable Boy, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Ambassador, for the overview of the situation in Somalia. I just have one question, Chairperson, noting the especially the last comment that the Ambassador made, that Somalia is basically in a state of war. The political situation and otherwise security situation does not look good. Now, with the postponement of the election from end of August this year to end of August next year, are there plans to work towards that election? Because I don't foresee the situation getting any better anytime soon. The postponement for a year is fine, but what needs to happen within that year working towards election of in August 2012?
Mukhalapa?
Yeah, thanks very much, Chairperson. I just have two issues that I want to raise with the department. I think we acknowledge and welcome the report and the presentation and the efforts that the South African government has given under the auspices of DECO. But I didn't see us mobilizing from a regional point of view. South Africa has not come out strongly to say it's not only us, but SADC in general, in mobilizing that relief effort. The second one is the AU slow response on this. I think it's a known fact that this crisis has been going on for 20 years, and the AU hasn't taken a champion authority in terms of making sure that there is humanitarian assistance, apart from the mission that is there in terms of military. But to add on there, does the AU have a humanitarian leg or humanitarian, just like the UN humanitarian agency, does the AU have something like that just to deal with this issue? Because of what I see is just sporadic and spontaneous, you know, reaction, immediate reaction to issues like this one. And we've been knowing for many years that Somalia is a country in dire straits. So does the AU have something in place, and what are we doing if it's not there to sensitize the AU that there is a need to have such kind of agency or such kind of relief effort? Thank you very much.
Honorable September.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you also for the presentation, Ambassador. Mine is also on the AU in the report itself. The role of the AU doesn't come through sufficiently, and maybe the Ambassador needs to explain to us a little bit more on the, because the issue can't be the postponement of the election. It's about what are being put in place to make sure that the difficulties that Somali is going through, like some other countries, these are the building blocks that are being put in place, and the determining factor of the date would rely on those things be met also. So doesn't come through sufficiently to say that this is how peace is going to be achieved in the area, and these are the other stumbling blocks that are going to be taken away month by month, day by day. I think it is unfortunate that, you know, we have a situation like we're having now that asks us to speak about what needs to be done about Somalia. So I think that one must come through. But the second one that I want to speak about, Chair, is we appreciate the effort that the government is doing insofar as aid is concerned. But you know, when you sit with a problem like we are sitting, one of the best things to do is to get popular support from your society, so that your society can feel part and parcel of the problem that is at hand. It is a known fact that many parts of South Africa are also experiencing a great deal of poverty. And so in order to make sure that your community don't feel, why are you attending to across the border instead of yourself? One of the best things to do is to get popular support around this, to make a great part of South Africa feel the need and why it's important to make sure that each one of us, even if it's just a rand that we contribute, that we all feel that these are the steps that we ourselves, notwithstanding our own conditions, where we stay and where we live, that we feel that we should make a contribution to end the famine in that area. And so I think, Chair, there must be a bit of a broader conversation on how do we bring popular support of our entire community. We appreciate what they're going to do on SABC 2 tomorrow, but it's got to be more than SABC. We've got to, and maybe the department must tell us, is there a particular program that you would want this committee to be part of also, and to partner with ourselves also on bringing popular support around this issue? All of us have got constituencies. What do we take to our constituents to say this is the program that needs to be rolled out for the plight of them? And as I end up, Chair, I'm slightly worried about, you know, Kenya does seem to be getting into some difficulties also. If you can comment on that, it's not just that people are moving towards Kenya, but Kenya is also starting to have famine problems. And what have been done about that? And I think that's why we would like to know the entire AU program. Thank you.
Mine are very simple questions, because it's a very complicated one. You know, but if you to deal with issues of nation building, it can be a Muslim problem. Since it's very short. We need to broaden this thing. We need to be able to appeal to the broader consciousness of our own society that how do we deal with this particular problem. Because if we leave it in this way and we look at the agencies that are contributing, it might just not be coming out everywhere in a sense of building and strengthening our nation. So I do go along with what Honorable Kony saying, that how do we broaden and make sure that everybody participates. But also, you know, I do accept what you're saying, Ambassador, that the President has made some comment in February, but there's no detail of how that is outlined and what is it doing in terms of that. And you see, what also I missed in the presentation is a security issue. That what do we do as a government into protecting the secret of the giver? When you look at the TV and you see that situation where there was, literally shooting taking place. I don't know if it's ordinary soldiers or what is those guys who were shooting in the air to calm down people there when they were looking for news. I mean, they were very desperate. How do we deal with their security? Why do we support them? What do we do as a government to assist them in that situation? And in terms of their own security, and in terms of the security of other people. What I'm also not clear, pledging 8 million, what is the detail? Where does that 8 million go to? How is it being spent? Just given like as a lump sum to those institutions to share it, or go to the medicines, or where does it go? Is there any detail that we could be assisted with so that we do know what we are talking about?
Thank you. Honorable Mubu.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to expand a little bit on what my colleagues have said. I'll probably go a little bit further to say that while we are busy trying to get rid of aid and coins into Somalia, I think the most important thing is that the political landscape in Somalia must be peaceful. That not only relief aid can get in, but also development within the country can go in. I mean, for the past 20 years or so, that the AU has sat on the side and watched the situation deteriorate, I think it's an indictment of the African continent that we are failing to resolve our own issues. Day by day, we have heard the stories that are going on in Somalia. So it's not really a surprise that we are getting to the point where we are now and the AU is sitting on the side. But probably, if a central system of government can't work in Somalia, as you have heard from the presentation by Ambassador, that the country is ruled by warlords, there are clans that oppose one another, why can't we have some kind of federal system that brings these people together, but autonomously in their own regions, in their own systems, if you want to call them that? I think that should work, because I think clanism in Somalia is very big. I mean, even among Somalis that are here in this country, we see differences among them. We get reports of them fighting among themselves for this and that. So I think we must go deeper and say, okay, if we can't bring these people to work together, how about in the kind of federal system? There's very little that is said about Somaliland, the other part of Somalia. But Somaliland seems to be working. Professor Jasper Ifrogu will give us a bit of information on this. It seems to be working because the government is working, but there's no international competition for this part of Somalia. Somaliland has a government that seems to be working. Development is going on. The African Union has said nothing about recognizing Somaliland. The international community has continued to isolate it, which I think is unfortunate, because if Somaliland works, then it could be a good incentive for the South to be able to work on its own province as well. So I think the AU have to really jack up its strategy on how to deal with this content. I'd like to hear the comments of the ambassador on this from the government viewpoint. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Honorable Suleiman.
Thank you, Honorable Kerry. We are presently more or less just concentrating on southern Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Honorable September did ask about Kenya, what's happening there. We would like, if we can get more information about the border situation, because the drought is in the Horn of Africa. What about Ethiopia, the other countries here? Because they will be also be influenced due to the refugees going to their countries, and they also got drought. What is the situation there? Although maybe we got a more political stable government here, that really helped a lot. But just a short briefing, even on the news, you don't hear a lot about it, only about Somalia. We can get more information, we can have a more holistic idea what's going on there.
Thank you. Mabus Kosan, are you covered?
Yeah,
I'm
not.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Thank you, honorable members, honorable ambassador. You have heard what the members of parliament. Before you respond, there's a follow-up or a last interaction by honorable Bui.
No, I just wanted to be more specific. In terms of the foreign policy, are we adopting a big daddy approach here, or what is it that we're doing? The main one here. In the other multilateral structures that are being engaged, I don't have it. I just want to get more sense what the foreign policy means here. Big Daddy.
Well, I don't know about the Big Daddy. Honorable Jacoba?
Just a small one, because I'm not commenting on Big Daddy or Big Sister or whatever.
Okay.
I would also like to just know, maybe from ambassador, is there a concerted effort from government as a whole? I know Durko takes this in terms of the program that is there, but have other government partners, I already mentioned there are four other government partners who have come on board in terms of monetary assistance. But you know, it's not just all about money. Are other government partners on board in terms of what is that they can do to assist as well? And as I'm saying, not just about giving some money and so on.
Thank you. Honorable, I think I see no further hands, and I will now hand over to Ambassador Mulekane, assisted by Ms. Adams, to take the responses. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. I think let me first start by saying that the situation in the whole of Africa and this drought that has affected or is going on there now is not just in Somalia, as Honorable Suleiman has said. It is in almost the entire region. And it is cyclical. It is not for the first time in the history of this part of the world that this has happened. We have seen it in the past, in the 80s, in mainly Ethiopia. And there was quite a huge effort that was made to try and assist the people of Ethiopia at that time. What is different with Somalia is that the problem there is that there is no government. And this worsens the situation because of the absence of a proper governance to be able to assist the people, and also because of the fact that this is a war zone, there is continuous war. So whatever relief effort that people are trying to bring into the country is limited by the fact that there are no proper government agencies and proper government structures to be able to distribute and reach the people that need this aid. Of course, in Ethiopia and in Kenya, because there are stable governments in these parts of the country, they are mainly recipients of refugees that are coming out of Ethiopia. And they too are now having a groundswell of people coming out of Ethiopia into both I mean from Somalia, thank you very much, coming to both Kenya and Ethiopia. But the pull factor seems to be, or the direction of people seems to be going towards Kenya more. And there is fear that the camps that have been established there are so full that they can now create more health problems in northern Kenya. Now, the issue of the elections and their postponement, which will tie up to what Honorable Boy was raising about the roadmap towards bringing about some stability in Somalia, whether or not that would work. That the 12-month postponement of the elections will work. There is, of course, a roadmap that has been put in place by the AU to try and resolve the political situation in Somalia. Zinet will speak a little bit about what is entailed in the roadmap, but there is a roadmap which includes the strengthening of the TFG, ensuring that they are able to attract the various clans and the various players and have a round table to discuss the future of Ethiopia. Of course, I mean the future of Somalia. I don't know why I'm so obsessed with Ethiopia. But to try and deal with the problem of Somalia. So the first point is that we need to strengthen the TFG, which I have said that has been plagued by a lot of differences, power play between the speaker and the premier. And we need to have that one supported so that it is able to attract representatives of all role players within Somalia so that they can be able to sit down and work out a discussion as to how they want to see their country governed and so on. Of course, there has been a lot of there hasn't been a lot of support, international support, but the AU has been seized with this matter of trying to strengthen the TFG so that it is able to discharge its mandate, especially that one of attracting all other role players. This is not being helped by Al-Shabaab, which is waging a war against and does not recognize the TFG as a legitimate government of Somalia. Well, Mr. Boy, our foreign policy is not that of a big brother. We refer here to the spirit of Ubuntu. We refer here to the African agenda that for South Africa to prosper and for South Africa to be able to deliver its own better life for its people, the continent as a whole needs to be peaceful, stable, so that all of us can be able to enjoy a better life. But in the midst of all of this, then South Africa will also be negatively affected if it does not get involved. That's what informs our foreign policy. So it is not a big brother approach. maybe also to link up that with whether this is not a regional effort. Of course, this is what we're talking about here, more of a South African-led response as to what is it that South Africa can do and what is it that so that we are able to show that we care for the people of Somalia. But of course, it was at the initiative of South Africa that the pledging summit or pledging conference was called so that Africa as a whole needs to take some action in trying to assist in this difficult situation in Somalia. There was a question about whether the AU has got a humanitarian arm. As you know, the AU has got different commissioners, and there is a commissioner on social development who also deals with the issues of humanitarian aid, social development in the continent as a whole. But as to whether there is a specialized unit that every day deals with humanitarian matters, I really am not too certain about that one. But there is a commissioner who is responsible for social development within the AU Commission. The mobilization for popular support, of course, DICO in government is leading all the other departments to contribute towards a central point so that resources can then be shared and distributed to Somalia. Of course, the various departments have up to so far contributed into this national effort that DICO is leading. And I have a list here that the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, for an example, has donated 2 million. Social Development Department has donated 2.5 million rand. The Cooperative Governance contributed 1.5 million. And all of this money is brought into the center, which is DICO, and then DICO distributed to the various aid agencies that are already on the ground in Somalia, so that they can then be able to do. As we said in the presentation, the large part of this amount is being used for transportation of things that have already been collected, but also to buy some of the supplies that are needed in the area. Honorable Boy asked about what security is offered to South African citizens who are there and providing assistance. That is the function of the AMISOM, the AU military that is already there, which is mainly manned by Ethiopians, which are on the ground in Somalia. So we do have, I think, four advisors, military advisors, but we don't have a big contingent of South African military personnel in Somalia at the moment. I think we would need advice from the committee, Honorable September, as to how can the department mobilize the entire community over and above what we are already doing, so that this thing becomes a more South African led, where the population is in itself involved. And I think the proposal that maybe DICO should visit various constituencies and talk and try to mobilize with the assistance of the committee. Of course, we do not have the person power to move all over the country, but I think through your constituencies, the various members of parliament, we can be able to provide documentation so that the committee can mobilize its own constituencies to play a role in this effort. I'm not sure if I've left out any other.
It looks like you have covered.
I've covered almost all the questions, but the winner may want to make a decision.
Through you, Chair. Thank you, Ambassador. And thank you to the Honourable Members. Just to come in on a couple of issues. Ambassador was explaining that in Somalia, with the failed state, there have been processes through the African Union to try and resolve the situation. There was a Djibouti peace process in 2008, and that outlined what needed to be done in terms of bringing Somalia to stability, which included the appointment of the transitional federal government and giving them duties and timelines within which to meet certain expectations, one of which is constitution drafting. The other would be outreach programs to ensure that the other clans and other groups are incorporated into government, work towards sustainable structures in terms of the transitional federal institutions that are governments, so in terms of the capacity building of those institutions, and also to look at accountability so that they don't fall into a situation of too much corruption. But there were gaps in the processes. And we have to admit that. Now, there's an international contact group that meets on a regular basis that's formed with the African Union. South Africa sits on that as well. We have a number of European countries who are contributing financial aid towards the TFG and towards trying to bring Somalia to stability. And through that international contact group, there's responses continuously. So there's a process of coming back to the table and saying what has been achieved within this period. There was a deadline. August 2011 was supposed to be the expiration of the transitional federal government, and they were supposed to have had the elections and to formulate a permanent government, no longer be transitional. Unfortunately, given the situation on the ground, they were not able to meet that deadline, and therefore it has been extended for another year. But I think that the measures that have been put in place by the international contact group of accountability, of coming back and of saying, okay, what can we do to support this additionally to bring the peace process to finalization and to have stability in the country, all of that seems to be happening. South Africa looked at that and looked at how those targets were not being met and what could we do to assist the transitional federal government and assist Somalis in general to bring stability to their own country. And we thought of a complementary process, perhaps, through the comprehensive strategy that the President has endorsed. Now, that would incorporate various elements, which would include capacity and institution building and support, similar to what we had done in South Sudan, to help the government to bring up its institutions, to bring up its people, and to capacitate it to be able to run its own government. Another would be consultations that could support more roundtable discussions, and we were working with Accord, the NGO think tank in South Africa, who already held a roundtable discussion with a number of Somalis, and I think Professor Dasai would be able to talk to that because he was present, and it was more inclusive, and we think that we could have more of those kind of programs that would be able to help us to share our own nation-building experiences with the Somalis, so that they could then perhaps learn from our experiences, not mirror them, but take the good from it and then have their own processes. We don't want to be the ones dictating to say this is what you should be doing, but rather this is how we managed it. Now you think about how it can work in your own country. Be that federal system, be that a central system, it is up to them to then decide what needs to be done. If I can also talk to the protection of the organizations such as the Gift of the Givers that go out to Somalia, we also have the consular assistance. So for any South Africans abroad, it is highly recommended, and in fact I think it should be compulsory on all South Africans traveling anywhere in the world to register on the DIRCO website, which is the registration of South Africans abroad, we call it ROSA. This is important because there are such disasters, natural disasters, tsunamis, earthquakes, and we need to have a sense of where our people are so that we can put into action the consular support and assistance that is required in case of emergencies, and to be able to evacuate people if necessary, to be able to put in the process of our defense force or any other arms of government that need to rapidly respond to such a situation. So that is there. We do have a record of the Gift of the Givers having gone recently. Dr. Suleiman called me personally to tell me that he was going. And the other organizations as well, we have encouraged them that they need to tell us where they are, especially when you're going to a place like Somalia, which is really a difficult place because of the war situation. To speak to the point or the question on how can we not make this only a Muslim problem, I fully agree with that. And if it appears that we have only approached Muslim organizations, let me qualify that in the sense that we did extensive research from the time that we had been alerted to the famine and the drought, and we investigated which are the most effective international organizations and who their partners are. We spoke to the United Nations, to the World Food Program, to the African Union, and to the various organizations. Now, these organizations in South Africa who we have approached have presence on the ground in Somalia. It is by coincidence that they are Muslim organizations. However, we would like to broaden that as well. But from the security analyses that we have received, especially from the Lower Sabelle, Gedo, Bay, and Bakool areas, there seems to be an intensified fear of outsiders, of people of fair skin. Even those of us who are of Muslim origin are seen to be foreigners. And so we want to caution our South Africans from going into those areas and rather working through the existing structures that are there, because we don't want anyone to be in a dangerous situation. And it comes back to the consular assistance that we do advise our South Africans where places are not safe and where we would recommend that they don't go and not to endanger themselves. I think in terms of the broader Horn of Africa, I think Ambassador has answered most of it, but we have been receiving reports from our missions both in Addis Ababa and in Nairobi explaining what the situation is and what those government strategies are in responding to the famine and drought in their regions. Yesterday we received an appeal from the Ogaden community, which is in Ethiopia, the Ogaden region in Ethiopia, that has also been at war, and they have also sent an appeal out to the World Food Program to say that they would like to have additional aid coming in their direction. So we will be considering that. In terms of the distribution of the aid, we are in consultation with the various organizations as well as the World Food Program and the African Union, and at the pledging conference we will also be making a pledge. So that will be determined as the amounts come in, and the amount that we have announced today is only the government pool. But apart from that, the other organizations, the communities have really mobilized to large amounts. For example, the Somali community here, when I met with them last week, they had only just started their motivation on the ground to their people to try and bring together some amounts, and within 3 days they put together 150,000 rand, which I think was remarkable. Other organizations that we've been working with, for example, Islamic Relief has already contributed R500,000. Africa Muslim Agency has an ongoing program. I don't have the figures for theirs as yet. Al-Imdad has also given a figure of about $1 million or $2 million. I'll have to verify that. So there's various amounts that are coming out from the communities that are being mobilized. And as Honorable Member has said, even one rand really makes a difference to these people. Now, what we want to do is to try and prevent that influx of refugees into Kenya, into Ethiopia. And in fact, as far as South Africa, we are going to be finding refugees coming here. So the best thing for us to do to mitigate against that is to ensure that the aid and the development happens in Somalia itself. And that's why we want to look at how developmental programs in the long term can be rolled out and what strategies we can put in place. So for example, Department of Agriculture is not only looking at giving a lump sum amount of 2 million, but looking at what strategies can be put forward for helping the pastoralists in those areas who are most affected to have a sustainable livelihood. How can the Department of Health help them to upgrade their clinic structures or to make those structures more permanent? What can we do through social development, or how can we help the Somalis to learn from our own social development structures and maybe implement them on that side. So I think those are the positives, and maybe this is an inroad for us to begin to roll that out.
Thank you, Ms. Adam. I see two hands. Is that it? This side is nothing. Thank you, Honorable Boy and Honorable September.
No, what I want to hear from the ambassador. I hear what you are saying now, but I seem not to get the sense. I still go back to the thing. You said that South Africa is more central in that international policy. There's no multilateral structure or a consistent way of how the AU is contributing to this own permanent or what is happening in Somalia. You see, it's only South Africa. You see, that's where I get this sense of a big daily modern, being able to engage the different African institutions to help in resolving the problem there. Well, this problem has been there for more than 20 years now. So then it comes also to, this is where I also get a little worried, you see, the sustainability of our approach. You see, I hear the human part of what we are doing with the NGOs and everything, that's very nice. But you are telling me in terms of government, what is it that is more sustainable for government to do in resolving or to engage into resolving this particular matter? You see, I'll be quite cool and I would like to be like that. If you give $2 billion to Swaziland and you don't have a consistent plan for Somalia, you're talking in different times in Africa. You're sending total different signals as people. But what is that approach? This is what I'm trying to find out. If you can do that in Swaziland, why don't you come? I mean, what is that? Here you are talking about piecemeal arrangements, solely dependent on what departments want to do. There's no clear cut outline of what, since the February statement of the president, what is our plan? That's where I'm coming in. I want to hear more profile. And I accept what you are saying, but I still am very concerned because what the other member saying, the AU stuff worries us. Because if ever South Africa is solely the only one that runs, then what is the purpose of the AU? I mean, how does it help all of us in this particular program? They've got good, we've got a lot of natural resources in Africa. How are we helping each other? I mean, how does South Africa work with the whole collective? Is it, are we weak in winning all other African countries to support us? Or what is exactly going on? You see, we need to have a sense of people in the portfolio committee to know that are African countries supporting our initiative, or are we running alone in the African continent? That's why other factions in the other African countries are beginning to influence against us. I'm just trying to find out, is this Somali problem a South African problem, or is it a problem that is being shared with everybody? Is the AU having the capacity to help us to get to resolve this problem? Because we send the kids to give us all the time, but will they be able to have a sustainable plan for us long term to resolve the problems we are causing concerns? Because these are long term problems that they are raising about really building and trying to assist them inside South Africa. What affects out there in their own countries, and what is other countries doing? Because if we don't have everybody in Africa supporting our initiative, it is goodbye. We'll spend our whole time with the gift of the giver, and the government won't be able to come with a solution. That's what I want to get out of what you are saying.
Honorable September.
Yes, thank you very much, and thank you for the responses that were given, but I rise again to speak about the issue of what I term the popular support of the masses on this occasion. If I'm right, we have 50 million people in South Africa. And if that is the case, 1 rand per house is 50 million rand. Just 1 rand. So I think there's, if we deploy a bit of creativity in how we want to do this, then I think we can have quite a great support for this thing. This is what I mean when I say if we want to engage the masses of our people, we've got to find a little bit more creative ways. I accept the unintended consequence of appearing that you got to Muslim communities only. We respect the month of Ramadan, and of course it is natural that it's the month of giving, but it's always the month of giving every day in the Muslim community, but and in South Africa as a whole is a country that likes to give when there are natural disasters and so on. So I think that there's a little bit more, Chair, that I think that we should maybe have a conversation about. I accept that DIRSO doesn't have all the human resources, but DIRSO is part of a very big government. What is wrong with DIRSO asking the GCIS to print a booklet thing that could be distributed so that we explain what it is that we are doing? That helps to get popular support and learn popular support. I'm raising all of this because we've been having quite a bit of difficulties in the country between the citizenry of South Africans and Somalis. There's been very many conflicts, but here is an opportunity to unite. Here is an opportunity to lend a hand in saying to South Africa, we don't need to just isolate the Somalis in our country. This is one of the reasons why they are here. And here is an opportunity to unite the ones around one common goal. South Africans mustn't be poor and hungry, and so too Somalis mustn't be poor and hungry. But Chair, I think as I finish up, there are other structures that you can engage, because so you know there are sufficient people. In NEDLAG we have a body that brings together civil society also. Clearly, NEDLAG should be convened as a matter of urgency to have a conversation with government, business, labor and communities, because there are these chambers. This is a good reason for them to come together to have a conversation about what it is that, because at least at that level of NEDLAG, you bring together the main sectors of our society to have a conversation there. But so too, you will have a faster way in getting to other structures in the community to have a conversation. I think we are blessed, Chair, with the one of the presiding officers in our meeting. And surely out of this meeting we should attempt to have a conversation as a committee on our own as to how Parliament engages itself on this issue and the role and support that Parliament would be giving, not just to Somali. It is more than Somali that are sitting in difficulties here. And surely as Parliament, we represent people. And one of the first things that we've got to do as Parliament is, how do we respond when this happens? I don't think it's the role of the SABC only to have 2 hours all the time to do these things. We have been elected by people, and it is our duty to lend a hand wherever we can in our own way. You know, I don't have the power, Chair, to talk about other people's salaries. But you know, if you're really serious as members of Parliament, surely we will take out of our own salaries and organize by Parliament to say that Parliament are pledging, like we have done when there was the Job Creation Fund. We made a pledge to job creation in this country, and so too I think we should be called upon as members of Parliament, the Parliament of South Africa, to be creative and have a conversation with the presiding officer about what Parliament is doing. This is not a time for grandstanding about if the AU is doing this or not, or FedEx doing this. This is a time of reaching out to where there's an absolute need, when people are in dire straits. And when we are in dire straits, we don't look at other things, we look at the immediate need that is required. Thank you, Chair, and sorry if I spoke too long.
Thank you. The Ambassador would like to make a last comment in as far as the role of the African Union is concerned, which seems not to be coming out very clear to members of Parliament as to whether is the African Union really taking its own responsibility in leading the African continent to make sure that we go through this one. Otherwise, other issues of what Parliament can do, as already suggested by the Honourable September, we can meet after the meeting as parliamentarians and map our own way forward as to what do we do to make sure that we put a hand, or we give a helping hand to this mammoth task facing us. Thank you, Ambassador.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me say again that this is not a South African problem. And what we're talking about here is the effort that South Africa is putting into trying to alleviate the situation. But what Vinette was talking about is the AU program, which South Africa is supporting. The AU program emanating from the Djibouti discussions, which brought into place the TFG, this transitional federal government that is in existence now, which was given a period of time to be able to try and resolve the issues there. We do have an AU peacekeeping mission, not a South African peacekeeping mission, it's an AU peacekeeping mission. And the AU has been issued this letter over the period that the problem in Somalia, the political program in Somalia, started. And there have been attempts to try and resolve this problem. What we are doing as South Africa is to support these efforts that are led by the AU. On the issue of this current disaster now, you do have the special envoy of the AU who is handling this matter, the former president of Ghana, Flight Lieutenant Thierry Rollins, who is trying to lead on raising awareness and also raising humanitarian assistance for this thing. But on the political front, there is a roadmap which Zinette tried to speak to, which we are supporting, which includes all of these things that we're talking about, strengthening of the TFG so that the TFG is able to involve all other road players in Somalia so that there can be a negotiation or talk amongst the Somalis as to what type of government or what type of future they want for themselves. That has been ongoing and it has been supported by the African Union. So it is a program of the AU, not South Africa. Baby that we are involved, but we are trying to say that we've been through almost a similar situation. This is how we try to resolve our situation, and this is what we think we can look at. That is why we're talking about institution building, talking about constitution drafting and other elements of the program that the president has endorsed.
Thank you, Ambassador, and thank you, members, for this first part of the meeting. We now have to step off this one. We have heard what government is doing on behalf of all of us, and we appreciate the effort that government is taking on behalf of all South Africans in the continent, and without really compromising our foreign policy, which members are very much close to or attached to. They don't want that to be misrepresented in any way or other. So it has been clarified that whatever we do it within the confines of our own principles of Ubuntu and supported by other multilateral institutions in the continent. We now have to give over to Professor Iqbal, the representative of the Somaliland Trade Liaison Office in Pretoria, to give us his perspective on the issue.
Thank you, the Honourable Chairperson, Ms. Mahal, and Honourable Members. My task has been made easy by Ambassador Rampu's presentation. What I plan to do is give more a broader analysis of where we are, end off with some recommendation and conclusion. But before I do that, I'd like to also compliment the gift of the givers who have just arrived from Mogadishu yesterday, and also compliment the other South African organizations like Netcare, Vodacom, who have been actively involved in this program to mobilize help and resources for the Somali people in their time of need. What I'd like to do firstly is run through this map, and if you follow my red light here, it gives you a sense of what is happening on the ground on a day-to-day basis. Firstly, in terms of geography, we have here South Central Somalia, which is where much of the famine has been declared. We have this sort of middle area of Somalia, and then we have, as Ambassador Rappel mentioned, this semi-autonomous region of Puntland, which is part of a federal Somalia. And then you have to the north, this area known as Somaliland, which in 1991 declared unilaterally its independence and broke away from southern Somalia. If we look at the map to my right, which is a map on the famine and what is being predicted for the month of September, as was mentioned earlier, two areas have been declared famine areas, the Bakool and Lower Shabella, but yesterday the UN added three more regions, and it predicts in the month of September this entire area, which is the dark red, if you like, to be a famine area. And as some of the honorable members raised, the red areas tell us these are going to be the emergency areas. The emergency areas in Ethiopia, where almost 3 million people are affected. And then, as we can see at the bottom here, Kenya, where also another 2 to 3 million people will be affected. And as we can see on this border area between Puntland and Somaliland, there's also an emergency area being predicted there as well. So with that in mind, what I would like to next do is give you a sense of some of the key players and how do we deal with the security on the ground, with the political dynamics on the ground. Let me start first with the fact that southern Somalia is broadly controlled by Shabaab. And as many of you may know, Shabaab means the youth. We have a youth deficit in southern Somalia and throughout the Somali areas, and that's why Shabaab today is very popular in southern Somalia. As a result of that we also know the other side of Shabaab, that it poses some serious problems to the entire Horn of Africa. We know at the eve of the World Cup soccer, Shabaab claimed responsibility for planting a bomb in Kampala. 79 people were killed. And if you read the latest UN Sanctions Committee report, it makes the point that Shabaab now no more uses Somali themselves in neighboring countries to do much of their work. They are using their Kenyan networks, and the report goes in great detail speaking how Shabaab uses also Ugandans to do much of its bidding in the region itself. The report goes into a whole range of issues of the functional linkages Shabaab has with Uganda, with Kenya, and also with some southern African states such as Rwanda and Tanzania. We have to recall Shabaab, the estimated revenues at the moment, which they've been managed to accumulate, is estimated between $70 to $100 million a year. And it puts that money to use to undertake its ideological program in southern Somalia through a very complex taxation system, through commerce, through the movement of contraband, and also the research I've done between 2007 and 2009, the group Shabaab in southern Somalia obtained a lot of diaspora support, primarily from Norway, the UK, and the United States. Also, Shabaab has a number of business interests. It has developed consortiums. The export of charcoal itself from the port of Kismayo brings Shabaab $15 million a year. Much of this charcoal ends up in the Gulf States. And I think you can also just imagine the climate change environmental impact of producing charcoal. If you read page 28 of the UN sanctions report, it goes into great detail of how this tax Shabaab collects in southern Somalia through extortion, through sophisticated methods of taxing farmers and so forth. As I said, its main source of income is the port of Kismayo, where $35 to $50 million it gets from customs, from taxes, because most Somalis are using the Shabaab-held port of Kismayo as opposed the port of Mogadishu. Now, clearly, when you read this report and you look at some of the current research on Shabab, it has a very sophisticated network in the Horn of Africa, and I think you can only imagine the possible implications for Southern Africa. I want to, before I move to AMISOM and TFG, make a brief point. I'm of the view that South Africa has no choice but to engage the Somali issue in an intensive way. The estimates of the number of Somalis in South Africa vary. If you would ask the UNHCR in South Africa, they would give you a figure, and you hear the figure early on. If you ask the Somali community in South Africa, they would say anywhere between 100 and 120,000. Now, if we take into account the current movement of refugees, Somali refugees, into South Africa via Nairobi, via Tanzania, via Mozambique, via Zimbabwe, the likelihood is in the next 2 years, I'm of the view, the Somali community in South Africa will be bigger than the Somali community in the UK, where we have the largest Somali community in the world, where the figures are 300,000. Now, as I said, at the eve of the World Cup and during the World Cup, we all know Shabab has threatened to bomb a few stadiums in South Africa. But I think thanks to the South African government and its task team, that did not happen. But I think we need to keep that in mind as we engage Somali issues. And we have to keep in mind also that our larger form hopes to go of a peaceful and a better Africa. It's very clear that from the research we have done, that is at the University of South Africa where I'm based, that when you look at the flow of remittance, although the Somali community in the UK is the biggest Somali community at the moment, but when I interviewed remittance agencies, they have confirmed to me the biggest amount of remittance coming now is from South Africa back to the Somali area. This is interviews done with the biggest remittance agency, Dafshiil, and other related Somali remittance agencies. Now, of course, that has a lot to do with the Somali entrepreneurial spirit in South Africa. It has also a lot to do with the fact that in the UK, Somalis rely a lot on social welfare and the dole system, so that entrepreneurial spirit is not as strong in the UK as it is in South Africa. But as one of the honorable members mentioned, like every issue, it has two sides of the coin. And we would have to keep that in mind as we engage the Somali issue. Now, let me say a few words about AMISOM. Of course, AMISOM is made up primarily of Ugandan and Burundian troops. That's the African mission in Somalia. But I just want to say the following about AMISOM. AMISOM, together with the pro-transitional federal government militias, has made some limited gains against Shabab, but at a considerable cost in both military and civilian casualties. The most effective local allies of AMISOM are clan-based militias with loyalties to individual commanders and who look to the African Union rather than the TFG government for leadership and support. That's the reality on the ground, that AMISOM cannot survive on its own without the support of local clan militias, and those clan militias are loyal to AMISOM and not to the transitional federal government. A lot has been said about the next player, the transitional federal government, but let me just say the following. I'm of the view that the principal impediment to security and stabilization in southern Somalia is the transitional federal government. Its lack of leadership and vision or cohesion, its endemic corruption is known, and its failure to advance the political process, which Zenit Adams spoke about earlier. Arguably, even more damaging is the TFG's active resistance to engagement with or empowerment of local de facto political and military forces elsewhere in the country. I'm referring to the other local initiatives which have been spoken about here this morning. Instead, attempts by the TFG's leadership to monopolize power and resources have aggravated frictions within the transitional federal institutions, obstructed the transitional process, and crippled the war against al-Shabaab, while diverting attention and assistance away from positive developments elsewhere in the country. I've said this, but a number of my other colleagues in other universities and professors, they are on the record when they are presented to the UK Parliament, they are on the record when they are presented to the US Congress. Scholars like Professor Peter Pan, Ken Lenthouse, have called the PFG a criminal enterprise, a rent-seeking exercise, which essentially looks at every opportunity to monopolize power and resources. So with that situation in mind, that leaves us with the question of northern Somalia, where, as I said, there is Somaliland and Puntland. Now, the assumption I would make is that more than half of Somali territory is controlled by responsible, comparatively stable authorities that have demonstrated to varying degrees the capacity to provide relative peace and security to their populations. Southern Somalia is the exception. I showed you earlier on the map in northern Somalia, Somaliland, Puntland, and in central Somalia you have two other entities which have been referred to as Gulmudug and Iman Wahib. These entities have evolved independently of Mogadishu, of any centralized state-building initiatives, and these are painstaking, organic, local, popular, legitimate political processes. But also you have now two other proxy entities. One is on the Kenyan border called Azania State, and the other, yes, the other is, and Azania State is headed by Professor Gandhi now, by the way. And the other entity is Shabelle Valley State, which is aligned to Ethiopia. These Somali proxy forces by foreign governments represent a potential return to the warlordism of the 1990s and early 2000s, which has historically proved to be counterproductive. Let me say a few words about the northern entity, as I said, called Somaliland, which, as I mentioned earlier on, declared independence in 1991. I'll just say a few words in that regard. The authorities in Somaliland maintained security and stability, kept their coastline pirate-free, and consolidated their nascent democratic institutions with a presidential election in June 2010 that was widely deemed to be free, fair, and peaceful. In the neighboring area of Puntland, the administration also maintained relative peace and stability. All the targeted killings have been on the rise in major towns, and they also made gains against piracy. These authorities, however, face growing common threats in the disputed regions of Sul and eastern Sana'a. With that sort of broad backdrop of the key players, let me cut to the chase, as it were, and go to what I would call five recommendations I would like to make, and which I believe we could engage in under discussion. Number one, I believe we need to mobilize all the possible resources to provide immediate relief to Somalis in the famine regions by tried and tested SA or Southern African humanitarian organizations. Two, utilize South Africa's diplomatic machinery to alert friendly countries of the emergency and crisis area. I'm making a differentiation here between the famine areas and what we are likely to see and saw early on in the map as the emergency and crisis areas, such as central Somalia, Puntland, Somaliland, and to begin with water relief and essential supplies projects. Water relief could mean water catchment areas, boreholes, and so forth. Assist in developing water catchment areas, agricultural and livestock support. We have a huge movement of people now, estimated at 4 million, moving towards the refugee camps on the Kenyan border, on the Ethiopian border. And of course, once a refugee ends up at the refugee camp, there's the potential of that refugee becoming an immigrant, either in Kenya or, for that matter, in Ethiopia, for that immigrant then to move down southwards to Tanzania, Mozambique, South Africa. And given that most Somalis are pastoralists, the big question is of water catchment areas where they could deal with their livestock, tend to the livestock, attend to their livestock, and in this way they don't have to abandon their livestock and move towards refugee camps. South Africa should consider facilitating a platform like the DRC for Somalis to develop their own homegrown peace-building solutions and the relevant heavyweight lifting and engagement this requires. Finally, engage Somalia's neighbors and key external countries on the urgency of a new approach to Somalia's peacebuilding and development. Now, let me conclude by saying the following. We are confronted with mass starvation on a level not seen in more than 50, some would say 60 years. Our immediate priority is to get life-giving support to the most vulnerable via South Africa's tried and tested humanitarian relief organizations. But urgency for relief work is no offensive banquet from our moral and political responsibility, both to understand, one, what heightened the emergency to a famine, and B, our responses to the emergency areas, which also require attention. Increased material resources are clearly needed. Even more, what is required is long-term sustained engagement and a strategic vision, a point raised, I think, by one of the honorable members of the question of details of that strategic vision for peace building and development on the Somali coast. I think it's appropriate to end with a Somali proverb. You either be a mountain or you attach yourself to one. Amabur aho, amabur kuturso. Let me correct that. I'm making this presentation on behalf, on my capacity as professor at UNISA, and not on behalf of the Somaliland Trade Office. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay. Thank you very much for the presentation and the latter part of your statement, where you were clarifying that this is a scholastic presentation from you as a professor of the University of South Africa. It cannot be linked to Somaliland as Somaliland's position. Honorable members, do you want to interact with the presentation? I give you the opportunity to do so. Okay, Honorable Kosana and Boy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to be brief because I was listening to professors. I could not help but reflect on a book written by one of the African woman economists. Dambisa Moyo, I think you should know her. She comes from Zimbabwe, from Zambia, also. She's looking at this question of aid assistance. And I think the professor you spoke about North-South Somali, and I think you're giving a little bit of a credit to North Somali, as if it's a little bit stable. As the South is not stable at all. And I agree with some of my colleagues that with the absence of the very strong institutions, government institutions, such as the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary, then you'd have that type of anarchy. And whatever kind of aid or assistance you bring in that situation, is going to be undermined and wasted. Well, there are the various types of aid that we know, the charitable aid, humanitarian aid, and systematic aid which comes from the government. But unless those institutions are there and strengthened, then it's a waste aid. Whatever aid we take, whatever millions we take there, it's not going to make an impact at all. The other issue that Professor, you mentioned was the role of the clans and the militia. Now, I think this is a historical point that brought the demise of the African nation state. That is the bad leadership. the warlordism, corruption. Now, whatever aid you bring in that situation again, where you have this kind of predicament, you have a problem, it would not have an impact on the refugees or whoever. But I think this is where, my sister mentioned something like a process of nation building. Now, I think this is where, because here you're talking about these elements, the tribes, ethnic elements, militias, all these groups which are very divisive. In fact, it is said that these conflicts which are brought in by the militias, the tribal ethnic groups, and so on, consume almost about four times of the GDP of a country if they are there, those conflicts. All that aid goes there, simply doesn't help anybody, goes into those conflicts. I think this is where the aid should also play a role in terms of instituting a process of stabilization, a process of nation building within those ethnic groups and tribes. The other point that comes to mind was about aid is what one of my colleagues was asking about, these pledges, these grants, these loans, in aid of what? We have these pledges, these grants, and in aid of what? Because we want to have an aid-based development, that if there are pledges and grants and loans, in aid of what? Why are they there? Why? What plans are around those efforts? We need to do that ourselves. We need to know that this kind of aid goes this way, this kind of aid goes this way, because what I said earlier on about the systematic aid given by government, usually it needs to focus on rebuilding, on reconstruction. It should go to things like health, education, rebuild the society. Where else do you have your humanitarian aid and charitable aid which goes into the immediate needs of families there. The other point, well, it could be a question here, Professor, about the taxation which come to that dominant group there, the Shabab, the taxation. How are they implementing this? And my last question is the remittances. We're talking about the money that's coming back from the Somalis in the diaspora. Now, do they have a common depository for these remittances, or they go straight to individual families? How are they then used to consolidating the aid that is coming from outside? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Boy.
Yeah. No, I must say thank you, Professor, for a well-informed presentation. But I do have concerns which I want you to help me, which I've been struggling with this morning. I don't hear you talking about the role of the AU and what contribution, I mean, is their presence making around that area. If you describe, I mean, the other part is very stable, Shabab, and contributing very positive to their own local population. What do you think South Africa should do? Because you see, for me always, it's nice to dream. You know, it's a dream to say that we can build a nation from here, when Somalians are supposed to be back at home. How do we dream along with them from here and arrive in Somalia together with them without engaging other African countries? How do you help us in that path? And you know, in recent times, whilst we agree that the West doesn't play the old colonialist type of approach, role, I mean, how do we interpret the role of the West? I mean, in assisting us, I mean, I had hoped with the continuous leadership of the UN that is unchanging, it will help us in this type of scenario to take us out of this. What is your strong view? I agree you've got a very strong view about TFG, but it seems not to say alternatively this is what could happen. Because if they are not in talking terms with Somalians, how do we get them to talk to each other? We can't use the military arm to get them to tell them quite clear that they've got capacity to repel militarism. What other options do you put them to the table from your own studies that could help us to resolve and get clearer and closer to finding a solution? But as I'm saying, and as my presiding officer is describing these different aids, how they are, what do you think and where do you think South Africa will end in 2 years to come? I mean, in relation to this type of an approach that we have taken at this present moment. Well, I know that the gift of the giver are virtual and animal all over the world to try to, whenever there's anything humanitarian that can go in and help them. I mean, I don't think we'll have a longer capacity to carry on in the way they're helping us in Somalia. What do you think should happen?
Honorable Mubu.
Thank you, Chair. Just two quick questions. Professor, you mentioned that the remittances that come from South Africa are very large from the Somali community, the amount of money they sent back home. To what extent do you think some of this could be used to fund terrorist activities? Because I don't think we know exactly where this money goes and to whom it does go to. Secondly, there are huge amounts of money that are paid to Somalis by ship owners every time there's been a hijacking of a ship or is it a seajacking?
Pirates.
Every time there's been a. I'm not talking about pirates. Orlando pirates. Piracy. Every time there's been a ransom paid, it's huge amounts of money. Where does this go and who benefits from this? Because we all know that the biggest export out of Somalia is pirates, nothing else. Thank you.
Thank you, Mukhalama.
Thank you very much, Chair, for just giving me that opportunity. I'll be quick. So I just want you to just contextualize this issue for me. It is claimed that the Al-Shabaab is rejecting the TFG because of their saying it's premised on the Western model. Can you just unpack that one for us? What does it mean? And the second one, because of I would believe that it should be an agreement that they are both part of or party to in Djibouti. So it doesn't make sense for me in putting that as a logical explanation. The other issue is on the role of the AU. It's not coming clear what the role of the AU is, apart from the issue of the AMISOM. Now, is this a hypothetical thing to put that the role of AMISOM can be the de facto factor that is making Al-Shabaab to be going on the offensive? Because of we are saying here that the AMISOM is supporting the TFG in its offensive against Al-Shabaab. Is it not that part of the problem that the African Union, the only intervention they are making is militaristic, in as far as not going towards the soft power approach of development and all the others? So can you just unpack those two? Thanks.
Thank you. Over to you, Prof.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll try to respond to the four sets of questions asked. Let me start maybe with the question of the role of the African Union. I think we just need to step back, and in a City Press article which I wrote some time back, I've given some background to this matter in some detail. But the thrust of that article I mentioned was that I'm of the view that any military approach towards resolving issues in Mogadishu and the surrounding areas is unlikely to succeed. I based that on the view that in 1993 we had UNITAF and there were something like 37,000 soldiers and that mission could not resolve the issue. So I believe a political approach is one which will help us and which will help bring about a solution to the crisis in southern Somalia. We have to recall that when Ambassador Jandara Fraser was the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, and she was under huge pressure from the Pentagon and the State Department to deplore and develop what I would broadly call a more militaristic approach to southern Somalia. We have to recall the U.S. has not forgotten what had happened there in 1993 when it lost 18 soldiers and three of the soldiers were dragged through the streets of Mogadishu. So it is the biggest humiliation the U.S. ever suffered since Vietnam. So its approach has been always guided by more a sort of militaristic approach, and an approach which I believe is very limited in the sense of viewing southern Somalia from the angle of the war on terror. So much of its policies are still viewed within that lenses. So it's in that context that Ambassador Jandara Fraser, then U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, approached Uganda and approached Burundi. Burundi at that time had a lot of extra troops which had been demobilized and moved towards the peace process. And Uganda had a lot of extra troops as well because they had just then withdrawn and defeated the LRA in northern Uganda. And that became then the basis for an African mission, if you like, in southern Somalia. I think you are aware South Africa was approached, and including last year when the ANC's National General Council met, took a resolution that the option of sending troops is not an option on the basis that it requires a political approach. So the uptake, if you like, by African states to send more troops as part of AMISOM has been weak. Ghana wanted to but did not. Nigeria wanted to but did not. So that's the backdrop of some of those dynamics, if you like, within the AU. The AU has been very good at raising the question of Somalia, having a special envoy, working with friendly countries in increasing their profile within the Somali area. But the AMISOM question, I believe, is from my understanding, a rather contentious issue, and there isn't that type of consensus within the AU in that regard. Let me come to the question of aid and some of the debates on aid. If we look at the Somali experience, it has proven that it doesn't need heavy boost and heavy amounts of aid for Somalis to survive. Early on, I mentioned the case in 1991 of Somaliland, where they started on their own without external support. It is only now, in the past year, Denmark, Sweden have been giving direct support for infrastructure development and specific help and education projects. There's a lot being written, a lot is written on the case of how Somaliland has survived without aid. The case of Puntland, when it was established in 1998 onwards, has survived primarily out of its own revenues, the port revenues from Bosaso, the fishing license revenues it has, and of course now the sad feature, it relies on piracy revenues. Which is not a feature which is to be commended, but clearly there's been a lot of pressure on the international community on Puntland to stop some of these key hubs of piracy. Now the question of how do we move beyond clans, a clan mindset. Somalis, given their current situation, their only social insurance is their immediate kin. And so it is their last point to turn to their clan or sub-clan to give them support in whatever they would require. There have been experiments to move beyond the clan. We have the case of Somaliland, where it had local government elections, parliamentary elections, and presidential elections. It was fascinating that when they developed the law for the local government election and for the parliamentary election, a party could only stand for the parliamentary election on the basis of the Nigerian model if it had attained support in more than three regions of Somalia. So the idea was to develop political parties are able to get support from different regions across clans and in this way come up with the idea of nation building. I've gone into great detail in my book in on this question and detailed it in with some rigor. The question of remittance, like everything in life, has two sides of the coin. Most of the remittance goes to the immediate families to help them. The average Somali here would send $100, $200 a month. And it gets to the next of kin within seconds. The moment the person approaches the remittance agency here in South Africa, the family on the other side gets an SMS that $100 is awaiting you or $200 or whatever is the amount. So most of the money is being directed towards the daily livelihood of Somalis. And of course, in many parts of the world, and South Africa has a very strong financial act which keeps an eye if money is being diverted into the wrong sources. And I think you're familiar, the UN recently sent a monitoring group here to South Africa, and they were happy with the way South Africa monitors financial transactions and how they are, the legislation is implemented with a great deal of rigor. While I say that, you recall just before the World Cup last year, the U.S. Embassy had to close for a few days. And that was because of a tap onto a phone where they picked up that some Shabab members were in touch with some Somalis in South Africa. And they had taken that threat seriously. And so do the South African agencies, of my sense, take any such threat very seriously and follow up on any such threat. Now, the last question, if I've covered most of it, is the last two questions I see is the question of the external players and the question of taxation. I'm of the view that if Somalis are left on their own, as we found in the case of Somaliland, as in the case of Puntland, and as in the case of the Islamic courts in 2006, Somalis have all the ability to be creative in developing peace, in developing a paradigm, a framework for nation building. They've proven that a number of times. But I'm of the view a lot of external players have not made it possible for Somalis to really develop their own framework. And therefore, in the suggestions I made, the recommendations, I made the point that if South Africa just assists Somalis to develop a space where they themselves can develop that peace pact, Somalis love talking, and therefore it has the cheapest cell phone rates in Africa, and it has broadband and internet before we had it in South Africa. And they're very creative in that regard. And in many other areas, and Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman will tell you when he went to Mogadishu, the resilience of the Somalis is almost second to none from my experience. And the ability to come up with new ways to resolve almost intractable problems. If we felt the DRC Congo was almost intractable, I believe the Somali issue and the fact that Somalis have proven their ability to develop peace pacts in creative ways suggests to us that our role will be primarily that of facilitator, to ensure external players are engaged, and that's why I had the recommendation to engage the neighboring countries, Ethiopia, Kenya, that some level of turning the corner is required, to engage the United States, that it's in their security interests, or what they would call homeland security interests, to resolve the issue in southern Somalia. The failure to resolve it would mean more refugees in the United States, and as recently as a few weeks ago, when the U.S. Congress had a number of hearings, they found that there are at least 50 homegrown U.S. suicide bombers who went to Somali areas and planted suicide bombers. Somalis in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. And the first homegrown U.S. suicide bomber was from Minneapolis, who ended up planting this bomb in the Somaliland capital of Hargeisa in 2008. Thank you.
Thank you, Prof. That was an enriching input indeed, which will help us as members of Parliament as we apply our minds to assist our government in making sure that the work they have already initiated does give results at the end of it all. Thanks again. Honourable members, we now have the last presentation for the day from Dr. Suleiman, who has just came back from Somalia yesterday. He and his team, they have done us proud. They have represented us well. He will be taking us through the disaster relief processes in that country. Can we now hand over to you, Doctor?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. Some initial comments. Firstly, thank you very much for inviting me to address this group here. Secondly, I must say I'm very impressed with the attention and the care given by this group to find a solution both politically, humanitarianly, and involved in the African continent. I'll make some comments on the disaster process itself, the humanitarian aid, and some other frank comments also. So I'm a very frank guy, so please take it in the spirit in which I say.
Okay, agreed.
Firstly, our involvement in Somalia started in 2004, in Puntland itself, with the tsunami that took place there, the time the tsunami took place worldwide. And we started, we responded there, and from there we've been there ever since 2004. We put up a medical center, we've had them with fishing boats and nets, we've helped them in Alula, we've helped them with cholera, with other type of crisis, with taking patients to hospitals, taking them to Masato. I have a small office there, and I have a Somali representative with a medical doctor who came to this country many years ago, and I came to know about him during that tsunami time. He was working in Durban, and some local doctors recommended him to me. Ever since then, I've used him. I find him very resourceful, and I find him very effective with processes and structures, with clans, with government, with, you know, the policies. He knows everything, how the mentality works. So he's been very useful. At the time this crisis happened, he was going on his normal route around Somalia. He goes to Puntland at least four times a year. And at that time, he was already speaking about the drug crisis. So late in June, he came to me and said, you know what, there's lots of thirst, or people have no water. So at that time, we spent $60,000 and sent in several tankers of water to several areas to help people with water. And then he said, look, this is becoming much bigger than the world knows, and children are dying of starvation. So subsequently, on the 20th of July, I went from Nairobi to Mogadishu. Only it's only a day, but you can't stay longer. It's a plane you take, it comes both in the morning and comes back the same evening. But it was enough to give me an assessment of what is going on there. Of course, the situation is absolutely dire. But now the problem was, as everybody knows, Somalia is a security hazard. Who do you talk to? Who do you deal with? What do you do? You're on the one side, you have the TFG, which is right, you know, does not have much respect for the people. And the strange thing is, we met most of the cabinet ministers on Wednesday. On Friday, 48 hours later, the entire cabinet was changed. Except the president, the prime minister, and the speaker of parliament, the entire cabinet was changed. The second thing is, I don't think the schools are very serious, because 90% of the cabinet members are from outside the country. They have foreign accents, either British or American. So I don't think they're interested really with their people. Thirdly, we had to find a way to navigate, you know, how our aid is going to go, especially we're talking about millions of rands of aid. The good thing is, as every government has politicians and they have civil servants. The civil servants were very, very helpful in the different departments. The governor was very helpful, and so were the commissioners in the 16 districts that they have in Somalia. The other person when we landed, we met was Colonel Low Catch, who was the head of the Ugandan forces of AMISOM. Very responsible, very wonderful person to have. On the ground, the actual South Africans, involved with a company called Bancroft International, was a very good ground support. Then there's a lady who's outstanding, a lady called Jackie Amamo. She's a civilian arm of AMISOM. And earlier the question was raised, is AMISOM only there on a fighting capacity or do they do something else? This lady has made it her duty to interact with all 16 commissioners, and if any aid comes in, as she said, very little aid comes in, the word says that aid is being sent here, planes come and this is verified by a South African who works in a company called SKA, which we knew before, and he is the one that does all the clearing of all the planes coming. Is that more planes come with people doing assessments than actually supplies coming here. Everybody comes to their own media team, takes a photograph, takes some video, goes away, and nobody ever comes back. And it's that very few planes have come of age, some 61-30 Achilles, and you know that only carries 18 tons each, one or two illusions with 35 tons, and that's all. Even the agencies like the UN, UNICEF, and WFP said, she said, we haven't noticed them on the ground here. And she challenged them to show where they are working inside Mogadishu itself. And she made this comment on the to our media that were with us in this campaign. In any case, she's been a very PR type of lady. She goes to the different camps, interacts with the people, and you know, in she took us to a compound in one of the old hotels, which is now in the underground base. They have a military facility, which is also a medical facility. And she said, look, this medicine that we have is for our own troops. But because there's such dire need here and nobody's coming and there is no international medical team anywhere in the whole of Mogadishu. And they see between 120 and 150 patients on a Monday, on a Wednesday, and on a Saturday. They bring them there, they provide the medication, they don't have an inpatient facility, and they take them back to the areas. So they have been doing their bit for the population and building goodwill for the population itself. So we have to look at all these structures, how we're going to get in, and then of course we have what is called food warlords. They take food that's brought in by whoever sends it, eating. If you don't distribute it yourself, it goes into the hands of these food warlords, and about 10% goes to the people, 20-30% goes to their friends, and 30% is sold in the market. And you will see the WFP bags and other bags of other agencies sold in the market. And in a crisis situation like this, it's totally unacceptable. Then you have the problem of the clan and the Al-Shabaab. And we had to navigate through all these different factors, and we had basically 4 days to sort it out. As I said, the guy put in the ground is very resourceful. Actually, what happened is the governor came to us after we landed, 48 hours later, and he said the draft committee is complaining that we as South Africans have broken all rules and all laws. That, you know what, that the food aid has not been given to the draft committee, nor is it given to different committee people, and we have come in, set up our own camp, went to the people ourselves, and delivered ourselves. So the governor told the draft committee, I wish every organization that came to Mogadishu was like the South African organization. That's what we want. We don't want any middlemen. We don't want any government involvement. We don't want any other people to come inside. We want the beneficiaries to receive it themselves. What that did do for us was the fact that there were beneficiaries of different clans in the same camp. So people from different clans stood in line and they suddenly realized that we didn't say, are you from clan A, B, C, or D? You know, it didn't matter to us where you came from, which part of the country you were, who's your political support, who supports you. Are you in need? Yes, our aid is to you. So, and all the commissioners came to our camp, the mayors came, the governor came, and the entire Somalia media came twice a day for the whole 8 days that we were there to promote the message that we were South Africans here, helping people of Somalia and not discriminating. And actually, the first comment the Somalis made is finally, Africa has responded to us. That's the comment that they made, wanting to know where is Africa. Now, the side comment is, I think our government's response is very slow. I think the AU is very slow. I think we're sending a very wrong message to the world. If Africa doesn't care about Africa, how do you expect other countries and other continents to care about this continent? We need to be more proactive. We spend too much time in meetings and discussions. Like the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Conference, I met them. They want to have a meeting and send letters out and call their ministers and have TV calls and meetings and go to Istanbul. I said, for every day that you are wasting having discussions, thousands of children are dying. And it's not your children and you don't show any interest. And this is unacceptable when you have big meetings and what two countries would take out $2 billion and settle the whole issue in 48 hours. But you are spending too much time getting publicity for things that you don't do. And they wanted me to join them and I refused. When we got there, they called us, they want to put banners around every else's aid and say the OIC is doing something, which we refuse flatly. So, we need to South Africa needs to make a substantial contribution. I mean, Mbeki spoke about Nepal, we are talking about Africa's development. What is 4 million rand? I told him I'm a blunt guy. What is 4 million rand? It gives a very blunt message that we don't care about Africa. We need to make a strong commitment and tell the AU, we need you guys to come. Africa is not poor. I was thinking maybe poor. We have the resources, we have the intellectuals. Most of our export is intellectuals. If you go to Western countries, who's running most of the facilities there? It's Africans. You know, it's not people from their countries. Why don't we don't believe in ourselves? We have oil in Equatorial Guinea, oil in Angola, oil in Nigeria, gold and diamonds in South Africa, and multiple resources throughout the continent. We have the resources, it's just very badly managed. and what is the accounts of billions of dollars of leaders in all parts of the world, we cannot say we're short of money. So definitely Africa can solve this problem itself, and I think this has to be driven very strongly by our government and by the AU. And to postpone a conference, you guys, we are no different from the YC. Keep postponing conferences, and everyday children are dying. I'm being very emotional about this thing because it's something you haven't seen. Let me tell you something. I can be very callous and say an earthquake is better. Because an earthquake in 30 seconds wipes out 300,000 people. The good thing is that they are dead. It may sound callous, but they are dead. In a 7, a mother sees 5 children dying in front of her eyes for 8 weeks or 12 weeks. Slowly seeing the dying child, a 2-year-old child, eventually become looking like a 3-month-old baby. Because he has wasted. And the child cannot eat, cannot drink, and the parents cannot even carry the child. In Somalia, the problem is for every one household, for one adult, there are 6 children. So 98% of the population we saw were children. Too weak to move, cannot move their finger. I took my daughter with me, she's a dietitian. And this one child she was feeding, every time she tried to take the cup away from the mouth to refill, the child did not want to let go of the cup, but they were so hungry. And this is the kind of thing repeated over and over again. We went through the 6 only. There's 16 just 6 there, and camps all the way to the south. It's impossible for us to finish everything. And you have a security problem, we can only start after 9, they have to assess the area, they have to check for bombs, they have to check for this one, check for that one. We had 30 people in our convoy, we had our own military. The TFG gave us our own soldiers, 30 soldiers trained by the Ethiopians and Ugandans, highly responsible, highly effective, and you know, commanded extreme respect. And we went everywhere to the camp and we had these people around us. But really there was no fear. Because the Somali, the TFG, and British, whether they liked it or not, the governors, the civil servants, the Somali media, ANISOM, and all the people of Somalia, they appreciated us. They went further to say that you are the first international team that actually touches us. And they come here and look at us for fine, they say we are hygienic, and they don't touch us. Your team shows us love and compassion and care, and they actually examine us. And really, every team member credit goes to the South African doctors and the medical personnel. They took their time, they gave them affection, they played with the kids, they laughed with them, they spoke to the mothers, and it took extra time because of the emotional communication. And we were trying to finish as many patients as we could, but the time was too short. We have to start after 9 and finish off by 3 or 4 o'clock because of the security situation alone. And you have to try to go through this as fast as possible and yet give quality care. The last day, the governor came and the commissioner came and a member of parliament came to our compound before we left. And he said, my friend, we've never seen any agency in the world, and they've come here from 1990 to this country and to the city. Never have we seen any agency so effective, so professional, so compassionate, so organized, with such quality medical personnel and such quality care. The supplementation that we took was 1300 rand supplementation for each child. So for the next 6 weeks, that child, if there's no other food aid in the country, will still have a chance of survival and not die like all those others were dying. One child died in our hands in the camp. We were too late for the child. In the camp that we went to on the fourth day, 45 children had died the day before. And they were dying every day like that. And so many other camps. That's why I'm saying I'm being very firm about this. We cannot be playing around and say, you know what, let's have a meeting, let's have a discussion. There's no time for this. Every day we wait, there's African children dying. And Africans don't care about Africa, don't expect anybody else in the world to care about us. And we can't do it, and we need to set the example. We're spending too much time year in and year out discussing what we're going to do and when we're going to do it. We have to do it now. No more discussion. It has to be done. And I like the idea about the lady from Parliament. Parliament has got involved, society has got involved. In terms of the campaign itself, I need to clear the mind, the conscience and all that, the misconception. This campaign is being driven by the whole of South Africa. It's not only the telecom or the SABC. Every media, from the day we made the announcement on the 17th of July, every media house, every hour, every day has been driving this campaign. Black people, white people, Chinese people, all kinds of people are calling in and putting money in. And one lady put, as you asked, put 1 rand in account and sent us a message, I can't afford more than that. 2 nights ago, my German manager was driving in Pretoria at night. He had money in the car because donors gave him that. A car was driving behind him, flashing lights, because what he stopped. Black person, I said specifically black, because people think, you know, black people don't give. Black person came out of the car, ran after him, took out his wallet and said, I only have 200 in my wallet, I'm sorry, I don't have any more. Please, can you take this money? On my, as I'm speaking to you, every 30 seconds, my website is sending me a message. Donations are coming in from all people of all cultures and all religions in this country. They bypass the fundamentals al-Shabaab issue, the piracy issue, Muslim issue, all kinds of issues related to race, politics and religion, and people have said, these are African children, we need to make a stand, and South Africans have made the stand. We've taken across 12 million men of aid already in 1 week. I sent in 4 planes. As you see right now, our 55 containers being filled with 500 tons of supplies going across. Our campaign, even before government money, will be more than 20 million rand. And this is the support of South Africa. Across region, across country, and predominantly from ordinary people, not corporates. It's ordinary people who come. Corporates are going to give you 2 tons of stuff for 20 grand, and they want more TV coverage than 2 million rand. We're not interested in that. We're interested in people who don't care, who don't speak, that are selling donors, send us 5 containers, we will put it ourselves. 800,000 rand worth of stuff. 700,000 rand worth of stuff. But it is the volume of ordinary people that have shown that they care about Africa. The question about the xenophobia, South African people, and in the township, I felt the pain of the Somalis. And I said, you know what, we're going to respond to our brothers and sisters. And every way, we listen to the talk shows on Metro FM, 5 FM, Okwazi, and you'll hear the comments coming through from all the people saying how they feel about this crisis and what has to be done as Africans, South Africans, and as Africans as a whole. We landed in the airport. I've taken a compound as security for my whole team. It belongs to an ex-minister for the whole year because we put up an office inside there. The police commissioner gave us the police force. The TFC gave us on the army. But really, to be honest with you, I'm not afraid to walk in the streets of Mogadishu. It's oversized. There's a lot of paranoia. People are very warm, very loving, very caring. And especially if they see you coming to help them with no agenda, people embrace you with open arms. And in every area that we've been embraced with open arms in the streets. Everybody knows South Africa has been in Somalia. As I said, the entire Somalia media was there twice a day or every day. I found something very disturbing in international media because we found our articles all over the media. There was a comment from one of the international papers in UK saying that trying to criticize South Africa and the African efforts and even our efforts, saying that somebody called me, an international reporter, and asked me what are we doing for the Horn of Africa, and I responded, what's going on there? And what kind of nonsense is this? There's a deliberate misinformation campaign. And this is that I don't divert my attention, waste my time finding somebody else, but I've got more important things to do. It's about saving life now. But really, we could crucify those journalists if we have to do that. But that's not the point now. The point is to get the message done and focus on the campaign. We can't think of anything else. While we were there, we were running the campaign here and preparing what else to do. We've set up, our doctors put life-saving drips on those kids. And every day we had 70 to 60 to 80 kids in the room with IV lines. And we did everything possible. As we bring the planes in, we are loading more important items on those planes to bring them to Somalia, to Mogadishu, to make sure that we have the right equipment. We gave them the two most important things, dehydration and malnutrition, and we are fighting that and other general diseases. And then, today we are opening up a feeding center in one of the camps, so they get continuous nutrition, not one-off thing, continuous nutrition all the time. We put in a big cooking pot, we made 4 plastic buckets, and we put a plastic bucket, every family will get one, so every night they will get nutrition. We are realistic, we can't save 12 million people, but we can save one camp at least. And if every organization in the world adopts one camp, we can save a lot of people over a period of time, but we need to do it fast. We've also put in piping systems to connect the water outside, so there's water in the camp, there's food in the camp, and there is latrines. We put up 10 latrines in the camp. I'm sending tents from South Africa in one of the containers, so that there is a whole new camp developed, so they have better management systems in the camp itself. The ship has to go because of the complication of the sea route. It's going from South Africa to Dubai. It sounds crazy. You go to Dubai and then come back to Mogadishu. But that's the only route. Because the way I realize that something's happening here, because when I went in the street, there's clothing, there's water, there's jewels, there's plastic buckets, there's printing press, there's paper. Where are all these things coming from? If the country's not producing anything, if the borders are sealed, if there's fighting, where does the stuff come from? There's no aircraft bringing anything else. And we found there's a very viable trade coming from Dubai, but certain ships that come every week. So we found that route, and we said we're now going to take the stuff on containers to that route. The task of cost for those containers is the cost of 2.5 million alone. There's no price you can put to life. You know, the planes behind cost us 2.2 million each. There's besides stuff on the plane itself, but we're not putting a price to that. When it comes to human life, especially the child's life, you can't put a price. I always ask the question. If it is your child, if every child feels about itself, all of us here say, if it was our child, what would we do? And what would we expect the world to do to save our child? If you can answer that question very honestly, then you'll know what type of response to take and how fast to do it. Thank you very much.
Wow. That was a frank input with emotional attachment from somebody who has been there. And I thought, because they've only landed here yesterday, he'll be very tired, but I have seen him. He is more re-energized, maybe by the plight of those children in Somalia. Members, do you want to comment?
No.
Yeah, the doctor has said there's no time for meetings.
Yeah.
All what is needed is assistance, as in yesterday. No more meetings. Meetings are wasting time. Mubu, I've seen your hand up, or you have withdrawn.
I was going to suggest that. No, I just want to say, this has been really moving presentation from Doctor. Especially considering that the majority of the people that are affected, the victims are really, you know, their kids, their children. And we have a situation in this country as well where our the majority of our population are youth. And it touches one when you hear this kind of presentation that young people, particularly in this country, is sort of directing their efforts to the kind of stuff that you're telling us now. They want regime changes in other countries. Instead of coming forward to contribute to this kind of thing, I think this is very, very important that attention must be given to issues that are important for humankind, other than involving themselves in politics they don't even understand. Thank you.
I don't think that statement is correct.
Honorable Kotana.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief question to our friends here. I see in the earlier presentation from the government, you have the aid organizations that South Africa is working with are Gift of the Givers in cooperation with the FABC and IMC, Africa Muslims Agency, Islamic Relief South Africa, Al-Inhad Foundation, Netcare South Africa. My question is, where are these organizations and efforts coordinated? Where do you receive all this aid coming into the organization? And somebody also mentioned the Somali communities in South Africa. Are they part of that coordination, or are they also working on their own, or are they part of these groups, and who really coordinates these groups?
Honorable Boy, you covered.
I just heard about Vodacom, so I don't see it on the list. Is Vodacom really contributing?
Okay, in terms of Vodacom, I don't know. I was across, I heard that there was an SMS line, that's what I heard, to Red Fund, that I heard when I was on the other side. In terms of our organization, they do their own coordination. We coordinate our efforts specifically. You know, we have our own system, our own management system, and we have enough staff, enough people to know what we do. Other organizations, two of them are international. They have offices in South Africa, but they're international. And because we are African organizations, we do things our own way, the way we work with them. So this aid, our gift to the givers, is only our own aid. It's our own real resources, stuff in our warehouses, and our own teams that we take across. The other team is, other point is that the teams we take across has a very South African feel about it. We make sure they're from all colors, all religions, but not planned that way. It's an open invitation for anybody who wants to participate, and we get people from all diverse religions and colors taking part, so we go in as a proper South African team to represent the country. The other question, sorry, one more point. The government has mentioned about 4 million rand coming to us. We haven't seen that yet. And the media has asked us about it several times, and I can't answer on this, but we don't know.
The 4 million on their way. We haven't seen it.
Unless it's coming by Mogadishu.
Okay. Can we get a response from Jeko?
No, last one, last.
Before the response, okay.
The MJC, the dog, what is their role? The MJC, the Muslim Judicial Council, people who don't hear that.
a religious body, black, and they, you mean this type of
I don't know.
But I'm involved. But generally, they, most organizations will collect funds and raise it and use it themselves or give them everything they want to.
Okay. And Adam?
One more point I need to make on Al-Shabaab, sorry, very important point. Whilst we were there, our presence was so strongly started that Al-Shabaab protected us. They contacted us, took on the ground, my representative on the ground, and said, you know what, we've seen the kind of work you do. We are happy for you to do this kind of work in our area. But the same issue, they had some problems about foreigners within their ranks and within themselves. There was friction, and they said that they don't mind our suppliers coming to the area, but we as foreigners, they have a problem with us coming to the area. Then he said, okay, I'm a Somali, my representative on the ground. I will come, and we're two local Somalis. And they said, no, he must come himself. And the goods will be handed over to their people and they will distribute. Of course, that was replied to the negative and said, we do it ourselves. We have a frank meeting face to face with you, and on that basis only will come. The one thing about them, if they give you their word, they will stick to their word. If they give you a document to say you allow our area unharmed, they will keep to their word. So because they did not have that meeting, and because they did not have any documents from them, and I trust, and because they wanted my guy to come alone, I give the goods over to them, we refused.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of the organizations, let me start with the MJC. They have responded to the call that government has been making over the last few weeks, particularly by our Deputy Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Deputy Minister Fransman, and they have pledged a certain amount. I do not have the details of that amount. The other organizations, as the doctor has indicated, work through their own structures. And the reasons why we are working with them is because of their presence on the ground. The amounts of money are pledged directly to those organizations. Government will, however, determine how the monies that have been pledged by the various government departments be distributed. Now, the $4 million that was pledged to Gift of the Givers, that announcement was only made yesterday, Dr. Suleiman, and I believe that Deputy Minister has already requested a one-on-one meeting with you in order to hand that money over.
Correction, the announcement was made last week Friday in the Citizen and in the Witness. When the spokesman for Delco was asked, he's written in the Witness check at the Citizen last week Friday, and he commented $4 million coming to us, for which we had no clue about.
Okay, Doctor. We will follow that issue up on your behalf and on behalf of all the South Africans. I will now give the last comment on this issue to Honorable September.
Chair, thank you. There really isn't much to say here. And there's just two things. The first one is, as far as I'm concerned, Dr. Suleiman gave us our marching orders of what we need to do as the representatives of the people, and I think that is what we need to deliberate on from that committee, that we should take that seriously, and from outside there's much oversight that needs to be done in this regard. And the second one here, I really think that if we would be right, and I trust on behalf of all the members in this committee, that we should continue to thank you. And thank you again for coming here, notwithstanding the fact that you came back yesterday, but you thought fit to come to Parliament and to come and address us. So we must thank you for that. But we must continue to thank you for Vukuzenzele. You're always there, it doesn't matter where in the world, to lend a hand. It doesn't matter what all of these other things are. But you are there. You know, unfortunately, and this is not an excuse, there are people like ourselves with life is about meetings and discussions and so on, and there are no bad intentions always about it. Unfortunately, some people have got to meet and discuss, but I'm sure the intention is not to undermine the efforts that you do. I think the plea from outside must be, let Dr. Suleiman get them the givers continue. Let us not take over what they are doing, because I think they've been able to show to all of us what it is to respond to the needs and the plights of our people all the time. So, Chair, on your and everyone else's behalf, thank you very much for continuously seeing to the plight of the people wherever they are. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you want to comment briefly?
Very briefly, I think what we come to the conclusion that early warning should always mean early action. This question of the famine was alerted last year August, but the lessons governments, multilateral organizations would have to learn from organizations such as the Gift of the Givers of how to undertake early action, not to lose any time whatsoever. The UN has an emergency fund, so I think the question we have to ask, does the AU have an emergency fund? The second issue, I think correctly our colleague pointed out, what role for the AU? The AU is as strong as its member states, so I think you need one or two lead member states to cohere, to mobilize, to move firmly on the matter. And as Zina had mentioned, I think South Africa has initiated this process and has to strengthen this process within the AU. The third issue, very quickly, is the Honourable MP correctly asked, what is the alternative to the TFG? The TFG was given a firm mandate that it should engage the successful experiences on the ground, but it has refused to do so, and it needs to be put under huge pressure to engage those successful community experiences, those organic, popular community experiences. Just one line on the point which was raised is, Adam mentioned. Exactly. It needs to live up to the name, exactly. The fourth point is, Accord brought some 32 Somalis to South Africa at the end of May. That was a very successful experience, and it came under the banner of a Somali word called Badigub. Badigub means for Somalis to regain and recover what has been lost. And that turned out to be a very good, successful, cordial meeting. I believe there's going to be follow-up, and clearly Dirko has a big role in this regard, as well as the efforts of Accord. One last quick point. I think the question you asked on taxation is a very important one. What I would suggest is to, on the UN's website, it has the UN sanctions report, and in the details, it just came out on 18 July, as to how that taxation is mobilized. There was a group of researchers, some 14, went into details of that process, and I'm glad that report has come out and it was adopted by the UN Security Council. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Prof. And we have almost come to the end of our meeting. Members, we have had a very fruitful session. We all agree that what is needed in Somalia is the political solution to the problems of the Somalis, by the Somalis, helped by all of us. And we also say to our Department of International Relations and Cooperation that the work they are doing within the structures of the AU and SADC needs to be reinforced. We need to see more results and nothing else. And as we all leave, I would request members of Parliament or members of the committee to remain for just 2 minutes. We need to deal with one or two issues that pertain to our own strategy moving forward. On behalf of all of you or the committee, I would like to once again thank Dr. Suleiman, to thank also the Prof and also the DDG from the Department of International Relations. It is really indeed that if we work together, we can do more. If we have to go out of here, all of us, with this understanding, we can turn the situation around. Thank you, and I request members to remain. And the staff.
You
can leave.
My name is M-A-G-A-U.
Thank you.